Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. I'm Christopher Shagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagelani-Albov.
Today we're joined by Markus Kroger, a professor at the University of Helsinki.
He's going to be talking to us a little bit about his work that he's done in the field looking at extractivisms and resistance. And we're really excited to have this conversation because he is also one of the original idea pioneers with the Exalt Initiative. So it'll be really interesting to hear a bit about how that came about.
Yes, welcome to the show, Markus.
Thank you.
So, Markus, could you please tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
I'm currently an associate professor in development studies at the University of Helsinki and academic research fellow. My current research project study the political economies of deforestation in the Amazon and in Finland and in other parts of the world. And in that project, I'm trying to understand the reasons and causes behind changes in forest cover, what are causing the fires in the Amazon and so on, and looking especially at the political economic actors. But I'm also studying other topics such as the global forest politics, more generally bioeconomy, green economy. And I have also studied mining politics, all kind of natural resource politics and investment politics that have to do with land and resources, trying to explain what are the different political dynamics and mechanisms and strategies that explain different outcomes. So kind of like coming from background of comparative politics, world politics, political science, of trying to explain what are the processes through which different developmental outcomes are reached. And these are, of course, very much related to such issues as the expansion of different types of global extractivisms and also into the process of building different kind of alternatives to these extractivisms. So yeah, this is kind of like the topic on which I'm mostly focused at, political economic analysis of power relations in places such as Brazil, India, the Arctic, also on the global scale to try to understand and then explain through these political economic analyses the kind of directions where we are going to and where we are at currently. And one kind of section of studies that I have mostly focused at is the global expansion of industrial tree plantations, industrial forestry. Of course, Finland is like a global core of that system, which some could call as forestry imperialism. So I have looked at the role of Finnish multinational companies in their large-scale land acquisition abroad in places such as Brazil, Uruguay, other parts of the world, and what kind of conflicts are related to those, and studied this expansion of tree plantation and so on. And for example, in my PhD thesis, I tried to explain when can social movements discontinue or reverse the expansion of these eucalyptus and pine monocultures of millions of hectares, looking at all the different cases in South America and around the world, and then trying to draw some robust conclusions on those. And then for my postdoc work, I continued from that premise and went to India and tried to compare whether the findings I got in Brazil about how movements can actually have an impact even in difficult situations in reversing destructive projects, if that applies in another polity. So looking at the Brazilian and Indian political systems, different contexts. And besides looking at forestry, I also then looked at mining conflicts and iron ore and steel conflicts in particular in those two countries.
Of course, you have a forthcoming book, Iron Will. Should be out soon. So could you tell us more about Iron Will? I mean, I was privileged to get to read the introductory chapter a little bit early, a nice little preview. A lot of really fascinating stuff in there. I mean, especially looking at these findings of the successful ways of being able to slow down and roll back this extractivist modalities. So I guess, could you tell us a little bit more about the book and your experience?
Yeah, so the book is based on method I call multi-sided political ethnography, which is kind of merging together engaged field research across most of the most important iron ore mining areas and project areas in both Brazil and India. So I actually went around those areas or gathered the material through other means. And thus I don't have any so-called logical remainders in the database, but I can compare the dynamics also across such cases, which are often left out because they are not in the news or so on. So I have in the database cases which are where the mining expanded, where it was discontinued, where the locals were against the mining expansion, where they were in favor. So you have cases where there was armed resistance by Indian Maoist guerrillas against the mining expansion, warfare, armed conflicts. Then you have cases of peaceful resistance, the bulk of it. Cases where all kind of different repertoires of resistance strategies were used. So I compared what were the kind of causal condition complexes that explain the causal path from the start of activism to those different investment outcomes. And there were key strategies that I found that were really impactful, and there were like kind of five key strategies that were most important. And I also studied the role of strategies that don't work so well and outlined them in the book. So this is kind of like a very topical book for the current situation around the world. And it's especially important for many reasons. Like, first of all, it has a quite good comparative apparatus, which allows for making generalizations about what works in which contexts and what can we generalize about different resistance strategies, because you have Brazil and India and then different sectors there, iron ore and forestry in the background, and also different subregions, different kind of contexts. And there's also the focus of the book is on these so-called upstream strategies, which means that you focus at what happens at the points of production, what happens at the mine site, and how we can actually start to solve the global crises mine by mine by shutting them down if they are destructive. And how locals have already started it. How, for example, in India, about half of the mines were stopped between 2010 and 2013. And this was mostly done because of resistance efforts, and not many people know about this.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that you found some examples that are often left out because they aren't in the news. How did you find those cases?
Well, I went around the places, did hundreds of interviews, did field research, contacted the experts, did the literature reviews, and actually going through and discovering all these places where they are by different means. And through the snowball method of kind of like getting to know from people, other people, and so on, and triangulating to results from different sources. So, yeah.
So you've spent a lot of time with your feet on the ground in both Brazil and India?
Yeah, in India in total about half a year, and in Brazil much longer. I lived there for several years.
So getting into the ways that are successful and unsuccessful. And this is very interesting. I mean, I'm more familiar with like the African context, and to a lesser extent, the US context, where, you know, mining especially is something that is usually very remote. Mm-hmm. It is something usually where like mining companies have disproportionate amounts of power. I mean, even in the US, when you look back to the early 20th century, mining companies basically owned West Virginia. So I'm curious, like, of course, like you're finding these, which is amazing, but as well, what's been working for people and what hasn't been working? I'm really curious because it's very tough for activists, I imagine, in such remote areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, the most important thing is protesting peacefully, but in a disruptive way, in a way which is like re-symbolizing and pioneering so that it attracts media attention or the attention of the power holders. The protest does not need to be a large one, but it should be somehow disruptive and re-symbolizing. And for example, roadblocks are such things, land occupations, marches, actually stopping the flow of the resource in different ways, like occupying the railroad or the export route or so on. typically causing direct economic losses of in millions to the companies or the and the state, and that way getting the attention, and also blocking the actual entrance of, for example, mining prospectors into indigenous community lands, for example, by the local indigenous people, so that they hold vigil and they are laying on the ground, stopping the trucks from entering. And as long as you keep the mineral in the ground and you do not allow the life on top of the minerals, which the industry calls with the technical term overburden, to be stripped away, then you are winning as part of the resistance, because it's not mined. Of course, there are different kind of measures in the legislative and other spheres, but in the end, it comes down to mass actions, even mass civil disobedience. And if you have thousands and thousands of people protesting, then you can really bend the, you know, the game and have a big impact. So the protesting was really like an important factor, but and it was kind of like a necessary strategy to be used across all the cases where the resistance was highly impactful in influencing the outcome of this investment politics. And I'm not explaining only the success of movements, or I think that's not exactly the correct term, but I'm looking at what is the role of particular strategies used by the local resistance actors, especially in the whole dynamics of politics, where also the corporations' actions and agency influence the situation, the government strategies, and what the state does, and so on. And in that way, I could say that the most least useful strategies are what I call private politics, kind of like private dialogues with companies through CSR or stakeholder dialogues, where you get the compensation against the setting up of the mine. In those cases where that kind of strategy was used by the resistance, it was not so successful in terms of actually influencing the economic outcome, which means like influencing the establishment of the mine or influencing the discontinuation of the mining project.
This is all really interesting. But I'm wondering, since you spent so much time on the ground kind of experiencing these things and being with these movements and these resistant efforts, can you tell me a story about what it was actually like to be within this resistance?
Yeah, observing the resistance there as a participant observant was really interesting. Like, for example, in the Eastern Amazon, in the region of Carajás, where is the world's largest iron ore mine. I spent time there around the mine and visited also the mine, drove through it and saw actually the mining expansion into the Amazon rainforest, how the mine was churning away the forest and so on. Saw the huge trucks there and talked with the locals who had themselves stopped the flow of the ore and caused tens of millions of dollars of losses to the company, according to some estimates, and talked with the people about their views. And then I followed through the railroad, over 1,000 kilometer export railroad from the Amazon rainforest into the coast in northeastern Brazil, followed the railroad route and saw how the ore, iron ore, was processed, for example, in the Maranhão state into pig iron, and how that caused conflicts there. And then, for example, there were local missionary padres who then told me that, for example, that the big iron plant smelters cause a lot of pollution for the local population, and that they were showing me these train wagons, which were like over 300 wagon long, kilometers of long trains, and saying that passing several times per day, and saying that this is like an open vein of Latin America, so like seeing their richnesses being carried away with very little given to them. And then I was observing the situation with the locals in that way, also in other places, in Goa, also driving around with the locals, walking over the hills in the jungles and sleeping on mud floors in small villages, and really being there and seeing the feeling, the emotions of the locals, seeing the nature. I think that makes a big difference. Also,
I covered a lot of ground actually seeing the waste scales involved in extractive operations, not only on iron ore or mining, but also in agribusiness, like seeing, taking buses in Brazil throughout the country, seeing places where, when I first went there in 2003, 2005, there were huge areas of forest, rainforest, and then after a few years, there was nothing. There was just an endless soybean field. You couldn't see the end. In a matter of 3-4 years, a huge transformation, a forest had just disappeared and you couldn't see the end of it, on end of the field. So driving there for hours and hours, it was kind of like an experience. I put on the Kojani's Katsi to play and listened to that and saw the fields extending, and there was like an open window in the bus with the fumes of the pesticides, the agrotoxics coming in, with feeling in the eyes, glyphosate and so on. So it was like a real tangible experience, visual, in all ways, to see the transformation, where the kind of resource frontier, commodity frontier expands, what it is in concrete terms. Because this is necessary to understand our current situation of global extractivism, that the scale and pace of expansion is completely different from what it used to be before.
Thank you. I mean, that's really, I mean, powerful. And like, I can very much imagine that, like that pace of change and how terrifying it is.
Goosebumps.
Yeah. Literally have goosebumps right now thinking about that. Something I'm curious about with your time on the ground there, and of course, going into the alt side of Exalt. Mm. Did you get to see much in terms of like alternatives? Because it's brought up a little bit in the introductory chapter about how there's a big difference between extractivism and like how that works. And of course, more sustainable ways.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what I try to say is that actually the resistance strategies and the conflicts are part of the alternative. They are the alternative. Because you have to create them. And for example, the Brazilian land-based movement, 1.5 million members, a really important player, they say that the most important kind of tactic or strategy for creating new habituses or creating new activist agencies and creating alternatives is to ask from people if they would like to participate in protest acts. Because often these people, they are from the most downtrodden parts of the society and they have been very passive and they have been told that they cannot do anything. So there's kind of like a Freirean pedagogy of the oppressed there and a liberation theology, political ecology involved there. And then they bring people, especially women, into these protest acts, or they come themselves. And then when they actually go and, for example, occupy land by cutting the barbed wire, and organize like camps, makeshift camps, where they then stay until their demands are listened to in their thousands. Then they participate in this actual transformation of the physical space. So they transform the situation in terms of the physical space and the symbolic space and social space. Their whole way of seeing the world and acting in it changes. And directly after the occupations, which they always do in lands, which they say that they have the constitutional right to occupy because the land that is not productive or that is state land but grabbed by illegal land grabbers should go to the landless people who want to actually cultivate the land. So when they do those occupations, they always immediately start to produce food. So for example, they cut down eucalyptus or so on, and then instead they plant food plants and start to produce their own food. They bring on the seeds, they build the whole housing there, and then they stay until they have been established and create settlements and so on. So they you have these kind of movements. Some are very well organized, others are less organized, but you have all kind of movements. In India there was also a lot of activism of all sorts, non-violent activism, Satyagraha, and these kind of actions where people used very strong will to really oppose these developments and donating their time and efforts and all with the motivation of trying to make sure that also future generations will have a share of the for example, the materials, iron ore resources, calculating that if we continue with this pace of resource extraction, that was the situation a few years ago at the peak of the resource boom since between 2005 2015. If we continue that way, then the ore in many places would last for only for 10 years, maybe 20. And they say, no, we should calculate it for the next 30,000 years. So that is an alternative when you stop the flow of the resource. It also affects directly the pollution, because if you have less of these key resources like iron ore, you will have less of steel plants, which pollute a lot. You will have less of construction, which requires cement, which requires steel. So you will have a huge impact downstream based on these upstream strategies, because they directly can influence the price of the key materials. And if the price rises, then you will have less of building. So it's also action that affects the global markets, although it's local action that in the local setting creates already the alternatives for those people who are seeing their homes being ravaged, so that the and their food products, for example, becoming much more expensive. So they actually occupy this land and then start to produce the food and the basic goods, medicine, herbal plants, and so on for themselves. But that action in itself also produces global alternatives. So there's, in that sense, no crisp difference between the local and global.
I think that is such a salient point. Recently, I was having a conversation with somebody that our guests might remember, Dr. Barry Gills, and he was saying that sometimes when we're thinking about extractivism and alternatives, well, the extractivism is the mining and the alternative is protesting the mining. But I really appreciate what he said, and what I think that you just very much echoed was that there's also the alternative of we don't have to mine. That's an alternative too. So it's not just doing the act or protesting doing the act, but the actual not doing the act of extracting. So I think that it's very interesting that, you know, a lot of these different conversations in different places, different ways, different contexts are all coalescing around the same basic ideas.
I agree with you completely. And also one of the things I appreciate too is this, the acting locally and the reverberations globally, all the downstream effects, because that is something that I think a lot of people today have a tough time really understanding and appreciating the types of impacts that we can have through these sorts of actions, that it's not just protecting our own community, but it's also able to have a positive global impact.
So the idea of being able to make a global impact by acting locally and being able to have these actions that have reverberations going out, I think that's part of what we're trying to do with the Exalt Initiative. And I know that you are one of the people here at University of Helsinki that was very much involved in the core seed of the idea that is now turning into this continuing to grow initiative. So I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about how that came about and why.
Well, the Exalt Initiative is a product of several years of work by many people at the University of Helsinki and also in other circles. And the idea is to bring together all the people interested in these kind of topics, especially academics, but also actual policymakers, that meaning also activists and other people who are really looking for solutions to our current situations and crises. So there's been, for example, a lot of discussion around global land grabbing. So that's part of the discussion. And then, of course, extractivism has mostly focused on Latin America. But what we are trying to do is to kind of bring this more into global levels, and also in the plural, saying that, okay, you don't have just one extractivism, but you have many kinds of extractivisms in different sectors, but also in different ways. That means you can, for example, have financial kind of extractivism or then more physical kind of extractivism. So we are trying to explore all kind of meanings that this word has and to what kind of directions it can bring us. And behind that is also a kind of discussion of trying to bring the Latin American discussion on extractivisms and alternatives and the problems and solutions found there to other contexts around the world. Like in the in Finland and Nordic countries, we have woken up during the 2000s in the situation that the global land rush has reached us also. There's been a Finnish mining boom, for example, between 2005 and 2010. There was a tenfold increase in mining waste rock in Finland from about 5 to 50 million tons per year. and that's really something that even the Nordic welfare state structures have not been able to cope with or follow. So with this so-called new commodity paradigm, where commodity prices have really started to skyrocket in the 2000s, especially since 2005, we are in a new situation where you have global actors, sectors, very much financialized sectors, looking for resources and commodities in most distant places of the world. And I think what's happening for example now in Finland or Lapland cannot be grasped so well with the traditional tools of, for example, the specialists in that region who are just focusing on that region. But actually, we could understand better this situation with the tools from Latin America, or at least use that kind of tool to study, for example, new Arctic extractivisms from a different lens. And that could explain where we might be heading as citizens of the world, and what could work in this situation also in different contexts. So that's one of the points here, this kind of global analysis that brings together the north and the south and different parts, the unification of different parts of the world, a new situation where actually you can see that because the commodity prices have risen so much, and because there is a rise of a so-called new multipolar global order, you need a new analytical tools, because we might be in a quite different situation where the role of natural resources, commodities, and sustainability are ever more important because of global climate change, climate crisis, all kind of other kind of environmental disasters, catastrophes, and so on. So these are not just anymore treatable as kind of like sub-dimensions of other kinds of politics, so that, for example, environmental politics would be somehow like a subcategory of diplomacy or politics general. No, it's the other way around. All other politics, all other social sciences are a subcategory of environmental politics, because we live in a bounded world. We live affected by the web of life, different ecosystems that sustain us. So we have to start to see the world more in these terms. And then we have these different approaches into those sustaining systems, the web of life. Some of those are extractivist. That is, they try to pull out. They just try to take from the nature without returning. They are not following the reciprocal approach of many indigenous populations and the relations we have had for hundreds of years, that people even in Finland have had with the nature and forests. But instead, they are based on what for example, world ecology considers kind of like a Cartesian dualism of distinguishing between society and nature. And we have to go beyond that. And we are looking for those kind of alternatives, post-Cartesian alternatives, and trying to learn from the different actors who are actually living through those things and that are already developing and practicing those alternatives, such as agroecology, food sovereignty, other kind of even urban-based solutions to the crises that are unfolding and becoming greater every day. So I think there's a need for this kind of initiative that brings together the knowledge we have around the world on this topic. And the hope is that we could have new conversations based on this in different parts of the world and bring together the knowledge from different fields through this concept.
Thank you very much, Marcus. So to finish up every episode, I always like to ask our guests, what can our listeners do? What can the average person do? this is sort of a call to action. They read your book, they read the Exalt website, they hear the podcast, they're inspired. What can they do to make a difference?
Well, I would answer based on my years of research, academic research on this topic, so based on science. I would say that the most effective ways to affect things are to use the five key strategies, that is to try to, first of all, organize and politicize some kind of social group that resists the destructive parts of extractivism and builds alternatives at the same time. So organize. And the second one is to also offer alternative ways of understanding these things, seeing these things. So for example, instead of seeing forest or making others see forests as kind of resource bases for getting logs or raw material, start to see forests as some like ancient old forests, as forests that have intrinsic value, that have a huge value, those forests that we still have left in themselves, in coping up with the coming changes, and starting to see that we cannot treat each other or non-human beings as mere objects or sources to extract from. So this kind of alternative framing is really important. Alternative campaigning through these kind of alternative frames and voicing those different views. And then, of course, protesting, participating in climate marches and so on, disruptive by peaceful protests, so that the people notice what we are saying, the power holders notice what we are saying. And then fourth is networking. So we should try to network with all kind of different movements that are important and in different parts of the world to strengthen the networks. And then fifth is we should not abandon the state, but also try to influence the state and actually create new state institutions and strengthen the existing good ones, the progressive state institutions, and make ties also with state institutions and state actors, but in a way that we retain autonomy and don't become part of clientelist politics or so on. And this would happen also at the multinational level with the United Nations organizations or other multilateral institutions trying to actually influence those existing places where these important decisions are being made. And it's important to use all of those five strategies simultaneously, not just one or few of them. We never know what works, but using them together gives a much more likely possibility to have an influence than not using any one of them or using just a few of them. We cannot know what will have an impact, but we know that when those five have been used, then by far their resistance has been and their creation of alternatives has been most successful.
So, if our listeners are interested in reading more about your work, are there any particular, besides the book, which of course we'll link to down in the show notes, is there anything else that you've done in your work that you'd like to have a link to for our listeners to read?
Well, of course, the new book will have the most up-to-date information about this, Iron Will, but I have also talked about these issues and in the book called Contentious Agency and Natural Resource Politics. And also in a series of articles, which are shorter in the Journal of Peasant Studies and other publications. And and there are also other material, which can be found from my webpage in different languages, in Portuguese, Spanish, Finnish, Swedish, English.
Wonderful. We'll make sure to have a link to your webpage.
Thank you very much for taking the time to sit down with us. We're really happy to get Marcus on the show because he's always out there doing something. So it's really been a pleasure to get to sit down with him and get this time. So thank you so much, Marcus.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris and Sophia. It's great work you're doing.
Thank you again to Marcus Kroger for coming on. Please join us next month when we'll be joined by Catherine Trebek, who will be talking about the well-being economy and social enterprise, and how refocusing our economic and governance structures on human beings and the environment can provide for a greater quality of life and environmental sustainability. If you've listened this far and you haven't subscribed or given us a rating, please consider doing so. It would really help us get the message out. We are completely nonprofit. We don't take any money to do this. It is a pure labor of love, and we just want to share these conversations and these messages as widely as possible. So a subscription and a rating would be a huge help in doing that. Thank you. From the bright leaves and early twilight of Helsinki, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sofia Hagelani-Albov, thanks for listening, stay safe, and we'll catch you next time.